Welcome to Conversations with the Wise, insights and practices for difficult times. My name is James Barras, founder and teacher of the Awakening Joy course at awakeningjoy.info. If you're having trouble staying clear and positive in these crazy times, you're not alone. I'm asking some of today's most beloved wisdom teachers to share their insights and practices to help us retain clarity and calm in the midst of all the chaos and distraction in our world. For more information on this series and to see videos of these conversations, visit awakeningjoy.info and click on Conversations with the Wise. And now, here's our conversation. Enjoy. Well, welcome everyone. I'm delighted to do another of these conversations with the wise, insights and practices for difficult times. And it's my real pleasure to have as our guest for this session, Dacher Keltner, who is a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley in California, and writer and thinker in the leading edge of what makes people tick and getting in touch with the best in them. He's a director of the Greater Good Science Center, a very highly respected part of UC that invites the cutting edge thinkers of our time. And is the author of Born to Be Good, and his most recent book is The Power Paradox, which is about how power can be gets abused, the abuse of power, and the possibilities of working skillfully with that understanding. It's something for all of us to contemplate. So, Dacher, it's a real pleasure to have you here.
It's great to be with you, James. I only wish we were in person, as we often are.
Yes, and Dacher has been a guest of the Awakening Joy course, and somebody who fortunately doesn't live far from me, so we get to see each other from time to time. So Dacher, as you know, I've been doing these conversations, particularly during these times, which seem to be even crazier than ever. Yeah. And asking people, and I ask you with this atmosphere, continual atmosphere of chaos and uncertainty and crazy headlines one day after another, how do you stay sane through it all? How do you hold it, your wisest perspective that keeps you sane and positive and motivated without imploding and or scratching your head saying, where are we heading?
What a timely question. And it is hard these days, to say the least, you know, when you become addicted to tracking the micro movements of our crazy president and then the developments across the world. I mean, So one thing I do, James, is, and this time has really brought into focus for me, you know, sort of a sense of what is my purposeful engagement out in the world for social change. And I think a lot of people are doing that with, you know, you were just at the march this weekend in San Francisco, and people are doing that with energy. And I would encourage your listeners to think hard about what is the realm that they will get out into the world and make a difference, and what are the criteria by which we make that decision, right? Is it environment? Is it cleaning things up? Is it saving species? Is it protesting guns? For me, in reading the scientific literature, and this is really true in my family lineage, it's about inequality, you know, and it's about directing my energies and resources to pockets of society that didn't have the breaks I had because of the color of their skin or the neighborhood they grew up in. And so, you know, I volunteer in prisons and work hard to sort of on the problem of mass incarceration. So I think the first thing is like, use this as a moment figure out your criteria in a rational way through which you decide this is where I want to make a difference, right? Alongside signing, you know, the emails that we get and directing resources, but pick one area. The other one that really is striking to me, James, is, you know, and I could also say like these kind of conversations give me hope, you know, with people like you, and thank you for hosting this. The other one that I think is really important today with all, you know, is really rational discourse, right? Is, you know, really treat facts really seriously, treat criticism really seriously. And you know, when you hear about all the gifts flowing into the ACLU and Southern Poverty Law Center and all these places that are really interested in kind of promoting rational inquiry, that really matters today, you know, and I do believe reason will prevail. You know, Steve Pinker, who's become kind of an optimist in this world, and he's, you know, has a new book out about, like, you know, in the age of enlightenment, we started to really develop the idea of common humanity, and which people would say goes deeper in our religious spiritual traditions. The idea of facts, the idea of improvement, the idea of progress. And so I think we have to kind of contextualize the present moment in this broader course of history. And I'm really encouraged by the activism and the developments of today.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you too. There's so many positive, inspiring things happening. And like you said, this march, this last weekend with the Parkland students leading in DC, I was just so inspired. Like, yeah. Wow, there's something happening here. I keep on remembering, you probably, I don't know if you're old enough, you're not old enough to remember, there was this song For What It's Worth by the Buffalo Springfield that said, something happened in here.
What are of course.
Jackson? Do you remember that one? So it feels like there's something happening. So let me ask you, still, there's probably times, I would imagine, if you're like me or most people, that you get activated and saying, oh my goodness, I can't believe this, and or something happens that really triggers some rage or frustration, or, you know, when that happens, what practices or what tools do you personally use to somehow stay connected and centered and hold it without spinning your wheels into the agitation and frustration, so that it carries on for a while? What practices maybe that you use or that you could might share with others that that you find helpful?
Yeah, you know, the first thing, and this is, you know, this is not gonna surprise your community members, James, but, you know, like the kind of course that you taught, the wisdom of meditation, the moments in yoga, which I practice regularly, reading Lao Tzu and the Buddha, and just, you know, I was really lucky in that my parents gave that to me as a teenager. And, you know, and like many of your community members, it ebbs and flows, and some days I'm doing a lot of it, and some days I struggle to get a minute in, but and so that's part of it. You know, I've been really interested in awe. And you know, I know when I've visited Awakening Joy, I've talked about this amazing emotion, awe, which I think is around us everywhere, you know? So I've been thinking hard about, you know, ideas about cultivating awe, like situating yourself in big things in life, right? That give you purpose and peace. So it's been essential. And then
before we go on to another, just give an example of how that works for you. How do you situate yourself in awe and connect with that?
Well, you know, it's funny, James. We started this research on awe 10 years ago, and you know, what is its physiology and its universality and its vocal expression? You know, oh, and all these amazing things that we study in the science of emotion. And as we did our research, one of the really surprising findings, and it caught me off guard, is that in different parts of the world, when we would track people and say, "Did you feel awe today?" You know, and we'd survey them each day for a couple of weeks, we found that people were feeling awe about 2 to 3 times a week, you know, and it was, "Oh, I was at a park and I heard a child laugh and it just blew me away." Or I was out in the, you know, the garden in Beijing where there's terrible air and I saw the spring blossoms, you know, just these kind of everyday forms of awe. And I've always thought of awe as like this revolutionary, rare emotion. And I was like, you know, that served as a challenge to like, just take a few minutes. We know there's a savoring literature out in positives that like just take in a beautiful smell. But I think you can also cultivate awe. And so what I do, you know, is I just go out and I think about how the patterns of shadows and light on a field of grass, or stand next to a giant redwood tree, and we have a lot of them in Berkeley and a lot of them in Northern California, right? And just think about the time that tree is spent on earth, and or watch water, right? Watch, we have streams here in Berkeley that we're lucky enough to go listen to and watch, and you watch as Lao Tzu did, just the patterns of water, and all of those just sort of ordinary things become extraordinary when you think about how vast they are and what their deeper meanings are.
So that takes slowing down enough for a few moments to go deeper than just what's the next thing that I have on my to-do list.
Oh, you know, that's, and I know you're hitting a nerve with a lot of your community members, James. You know, for me, it's like I wake up with a to-do list in my head, you know, and I go right to my computer. I'm checking my phone, you know, I'm not alone.
No, you're not.
And now, literally, it's like, I make sure I'm outside, mm-hmm. 5-10 minutes a day, do it, mm-hmm. just breathing, right? Mm-hmm. And then thinking about these awe contemplations, mm-hmm. and building them into walking places, hikes, conversations. It's a close relative of mindfulness in some sense. But building mm-hmm. upon it, mm-hmm. That's been really helpful. Really helpful. Yeah.
So sometimes you're reminding me actually of something that I do along these lines, and I haven't put it in this context. But when I every now and then, if I feel myself speeding up a bit, I imagine that I'm in the middle of a retreat at Spirit Rock, and there I am like, oh, reaching for my hairbrush and combing my hair. And oh, if I was in the middle of the retreat, this would be just such a fantastic moment. And
yeah, that's cool.
One of the things, if you have done retreats like that, it's like dropping into that, moving from the fast lane, not just to the middle or slow lane, but to the really slow lane, and just stopping and, oh, I'm alive. Hey, this is a pretty neat moment. And it reminds me, I love this line from Einstein. He says, there's two ways to go through life. One is seeing nothing as a miracle, and the other is seeing everything as a miracle.
Yeah,
and,
well put.
That's the key right there.
So, yeah, you know, it's so, you're pointing to this really deep notion, James, that I'm not sure science could ever really capture, which is as you develop a contemplative practice, you have these experiences that are residing in your mind that you can call upon, right? And that moment of like, well, I'm doing a slow walking meditation, or feeling the hairbrush on my head, or whatever the case may be, you can call up that experience and it imbues the present moment, right? And it points to this really interesting sort of counterintuitive notion about awe that we've just documented in a study, which is, you know, a lot of people intuitively feel that if I the more I seek awe and the more I practice it, I'll kind of eliminate it in my life, right? It'll flatten out, I'll sort of eliminate its mystery. And we find just the opposite, right? That we have this one study with Virginia Sturm at UC San Francisco. We had 75-year-olds do an awe walk a few times a week for 8 weeks. You know, and they go out and find their favorite place in the city or in a park and just take in the vastness and the miracles. Mm-hmm. And what we find is their awe increases over time. Yeah. So I love what you're saying. I wish we could get it in the lab, but I still believe it.
You got your awe radar out. And that doesn't that become, I know you're quite familiar with confirmation bias, that the more you look for something, or the more you are inclined to look for it, your brain actually picks it out.
Yeah, I think so. I think absolutely. So the right kind of confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm. So you were saying, okay, so awe was one practice, and yeah. You were about to say another.
Well, one. You know, and this is right at the core of mindfulness, non-judgmental awareness of thoughts and feelings. And over in the scientific literature, which complements that wisdom, what we're learning, and you know, this has been a hard one for me to really grasp and really integrate, which is, you know, negative emotions have their purposes, right? Fear has a purpose. Sadness has a sublime purpose of reconnecting us with people we love. Anxiety has a purpose, disgust has a purpose, and anger has a purpose, right? It really is about protest and ameliorating injustice. Humans have a lot of studies show, it's now about 27 different studies in many different countries in the world, we prefer near equality, right? We kind of want things to be fairly similar for the people in our tribe or our community or our nation. And when we see people like Trump, who's basically just shifting yet again resources to the 1% and his buddies in the most unethical fashion, we are enraged. And that's an old sentiment, right? That's an old emotion in our evolutionary history. And what the wisdom is telling us is just to say, it's okay. You know, it is okay to still be angry about this. Because there's purpose behind it. It animates action like your protest this weekend. And what we know neuroscientifically is if I just say, I'm angry, you know, it's okay. This will lead to a course of action. The very specific parts of your prefrontal cortex communicate with the amygdala and other regions of your older brain and calm it down, right? So you end up in this state of righteous anger or justified anger. So, you know, I know there are debates in the contemplative circles about anger, and clearly we don't want to fall into resentment, but in the present moment, it's okay.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that knowing that you're angry is an important part of just being, having it activated and being swept up by it. You have to know consciously, oh, I'm really angry now, and that gives you more possibility to not act from that that hateful place.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, I mean, when I've been around His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and we ask him about compassion, should we always feel it? Should we feel it towards every moment, every person, every moment? It's like, well, there's smart compassion, right? There's reasoned compassion. And the same is true of all the emotion. There is reasoned fear, you know. I've had a lot of anxiety in my life when it was unreasonable, you know, panic attacks, and you track your heart and you think you're dying, and then it subsides, and you know, and then eventually reason kind of balances out those passionate responses. And the same is true today for our feelings of anger and rage, is to place it in context. Let it animate inquiry and thought and action. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll arrive at a better place.
So this is really an interesting point for me, and I want to get your take on it. So the anger gets activated And there's a kind, it affects your whole system physically, physiologically, as well as mentally and emotionally. And you might know, oh, I'm really ticked off right now.
Yeah.
And it seems like there's a choice here. Sometimes I can know I'm ticked off and still get swept up by it. How to go from that knowing somewhere your prefrontal cortex is tracking it, but you get swept up. How you go from there to underneath that place of deep caring, that's the source of that anger, instead of going for the next 4 hours on a rant about our crazy result.
Well, you know, for me, you know, and it's interesting, there is this this notion in the moral psychology literature that some of your community members probably have heard about and tracked a bit, which is we have all these moral reactions like today of rage and disgust with, you know, Trump's unethical behavior and the like, but underlying perhaps the core, you know, foundation to our moral reactions is harm, is the sense that, you know, unfair actions, why we deem them unfair is because it harms individuals. And disgusting, repulsive actions at the workplace that led to the Me Too movement, at their core, is harming a young woman who's trying to rise and being sexually harassed, or, you know, pay inequities in the United States. Ultimately, the reason we feel enraged is there's somebody who's not, is being harmed by unfair pay, the 1 in 5 children who are in poverty. And so I think that ultimately these deep moral reactions get us to the foundation, which is harm. And humans, as you know better than me, have massive old responses where we want to reduce harm in the world. You know, in the protests this weekend, they may have had rage and, you know, drama and anger, but what drives those protests is harm reduction. And I think that once you keep an eye on that idea, it gives you this sense of caring at the core of our political action.
Seems to be the key transmutation where that wants to a harnessed caring and commitment like those kids in Parkland and that have somehow awakened that same sense of righteous indignation to channel it for a positive. And that to me is the key shift, that if enough people care,
yeah,
and aren't just getting lost in their rage, but in saying, okay, I'm going to make a difference, and their action expresses their anxiety and into channeled skillful ways, that I think is going to be the key. So let me ask you, so your book, The Power Paradox and Abuse of Power, anything you can say that might be relevant to what we're going through, that you can share in a few minutes?
Yeah, you know, so it's been a really interesting journey, James, you know, and it aligns with the political moment. And I didn't really want to write a book about politics, but I've been studying power for 25 years alongside compassion and awe and love. Those are my two areas of scientific study. And, you know, it's interesting, like you, I am a child of the 60s and was struck by the enormous social change that's brought about by, you know, people who don't have a lot of money and wealth and, you know, civil rights and women's rights and Vietnam War protests and the like. And so the first part of the book is really about how power, we need to rethink what power is. And it really is about advancing the greater good, right? And lifting up people in a social network. And that thesis, a lot of people believe, but when I published the book, I published it in May, and Trump announces his presidential candidacy in June, and everybody's like, what's this crazy birthday guy writing about? You know, the power's about lifting up people. And here's this guy who's tearing things apart to rise in power. Mm-hmm. Although I think that there are nuanced questions to ask there. And then the next part of the book is about how once you have power and you're privileged and you have a lot of wealth and you're from a privileged part of society, you just abuse power to gratify your own desires. And then once the truth about Trump came out, I got a lot of calls my book was everywhere, right? People were like, see, this guy predicted it. But more importantly, at the end of the book, what I write about is how much this costs us, you know? And, you know, I grew up around very poor rural people who probably voted for Trump. And we now know that they're living lives empirically that are shorter than their parents, right? Poor white rural people. They're really good, kind human beings, but they're being screwed over by Wall Street and Washington, D.C. and Trump. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the arc of the book. And it's so timely we're talking today, James, because, you know, one of the things that I really push in the book is, and I think a lot of people thinking about contemporary 21st century culture are saying this, which is power, more so than in a large swath of human history, is in our own hands, you know, and it really is in protests and in what you write and in what you do out in the world. You know, we don't have strong institutions like we used to have, where a church would tell us what to believe or the medical doctor would insist on how we get cured or whatever it is. It is power is much more distributed today. And that's the challenge for us, is to find it, feel it, and then go do something about it vis-a-vis the rise in authoritarianism, which you see in different parts of the world. So I take a more optimistic view of power, you know, and I took a beating early in Trump's rise, but I think there are a lot of interesting signs for optimism.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that the abuse of power can lead to a kind of wake up that brings the opposite action.
That's a really neat, it's almost like a dialectic, and I wish I had made that argument more explicit, James. That's a really interesting idea, that we as communities and, you know, democracies respond to the abuses of power with force. And it doesn't matter how much money we have or if the police are on our side, we will respond. And that produces social change. You know, if you read the history of the student protests, mm-hmm. you know, inspired by civil rights, you know, beginning in many ways here at Berkeley, and how they spread to the Vietnam War protests, mm-hmm. And as the facts came out about the Vietnam War, that's a kind of a canonical example. And I think we're in another moment today.
Mm-hmm. So, in fact, I sometimes think of Trump as a kind of, this might seem a bit blasphemous, but a kind of bodhisattva, an unwitting bodhisattva that through his own persona has woken up the status quo and catalyzed a response that might not have happened if the status quo had continued. And I know for me, for instance, I'm more patriotic than I've been since John F. Kennedy. And
yeah.
Say, okay, enough. It feels like I'm part of a zeitgeist that's happening that so many are feeling, that there's a wake-up call to the power abuse.
You know, and I have to just on that theme, James, and it's so great to hear your own reflections. You know, out of the book, The Power Paradox, I was approached to write about sexual harassment when the Me Too movement happened. And Me Too is a catalyzed, galvanized movement in response to Trump and then all the routine abuses that 50 to 80% of American women face at work. And that got me into all these conversations, you know, on panels at Davos and elsewhere, where I was the only man talking about the science of the abuse of power around women who are part of this movement. And that is a game-changing movement that has been inspired by Donald Trump. So, you know, we can be grateful for them.
Mm-hmm. One thing that that I have been reflecting on, I forget where I first read this idea, but within the United States, our history is one of justice and reaction to oppression, and so it's in our DNA that says no, this isn't fair, in a different way than say a lot of the European countries or countries where dictators and kings and feudal system. It's so much a part of their DNA that there's this more of this sense of, oh, what can we do? But here it's in our culture that no, our country was founded on life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So there's something good to be said for the American DNA.
I agree. I mean, our capacity to protest is, you know, it can unnerve us when skinheads have the right to protest, or, you know, here at Berkeley, as many of your listeners will know, we had a bunch of white supremacists show up on our campus and disrupt stuff, you know, and I saw them firsthand and that was unnerving. But, you know, I do have faith that the deeper care-oriented protesting is what's driving our history forward.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, let me ask you, something I've been asking people who come in this series. I always feel that it's helpful to have some kind of a positive vision to inspire and have a direction. So I'm curious, Dacre, what would be your most inspired or positive vision of where we're headed, you know, even given besides beyond this presidency? We're talking about climate change and all kinds of ways that humanity could be headed on a self-destructive trajectory.
Yeah.
But it could be headed, you know, in other ways. And just would you share how you hold in your better moments where we're heading?
Well, I'd really cite two big trends, James. And the first is, you know, and I wish I write a bit about this in The Power Paradox, which is women are rising to positions of power in unprecedented fashion, more so than in the last 15,000 years. And when you just look at their presence in medicine and law and education and universities and, you know, politics, and we, the United States, are a little bit trailing in terms of this. But I think this is a reason for serious optimism. And the second thing is, you know, you and I, you know, you longer than me, but, you know, we've been talking about alternative ways of being, a little bit less materialistic, a little bit more local, a little bit more compassionate. And the new generation, you know, the students I teach at Berkeley, they are less materialistic than the past generation. They will use fewer carbon resources. They are not as bought into owning homes or cars. They are more willing to do alternative things, you know. So I am awestruck at that next generation and what they're up to. And they are taking in, like, these conversations that we've all been having. You know, you've been one of our leaders about compassion-oriented, you know, economies or social institutions. They care about it. So that gives me hope. And I, you know, sorry to go on, but, you know.
No, please.
You know, the third thing that's really interesting to me, you know, is, you know, you've been at this for some time and talking about compassion and joy and mindfulness and contemplative ways of being in the world. And, you know, at the Greater Good Science Center, I've been lucky enough to follow our writers and how they're seeing this, your ideas spread to our culture. And it's happening in prisons. It's going to happen in a big way in the next 15 years in healthcare. It's going to be probably the central change in American healthcare. You know, Vivek Murthy, our former Surgeon General, calls me up out of the blue and he's like, you know, the central health problem in the United States is loneliness and disconnect. And that's what we have to fix. Not, you know, not necessarily dietary practices or genetic propensities, but social connectedness. So I feel like the fight has just begun, and there's a lot of reason for hope.
And I know that you, in Born to Be Good, and when you come to the Joy Course, one of the things that I've always been inspired by is you talking about that we're wired up for goodness. That's our innate response to the world, what we want to have. So that must give you a perspective that there's some good possibilities here.
It's amazing, James. You know, I mean, I saw you tear up when you thought about the rally this weekend, and that's a response of there's still hope. Look at what young people are doing, how emergent and powerful it is, and that is a form of power. In my thinking about your reaction, I teared up. And those are just responses of how incredible human beings can be to each other, right? And we're wired with tears and the vagus nerve and oxytocin and old parts of the brain just to care, you know? And so I feel it more strongly today in this era of Trump than ever. And we just got to build on that.
Here. I'm with you. Well, nice to be building and walking and doing this journey together with you.
I agree, James. I always consider it sacred to be with you. More.
Thanks so much for taking your time and sharing your thoughts and your good heart with us. And keep up that good scientific backing that confirms that we're really good at heart.
Thank you, James.
Okay, see you, Dacher.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Conversations with the Wise, Insights and Practices for Difficult Times. For more information on this series and to see the video of this and other conversations, please visit awakeningjoy.info and follow the links. We'd love to hear from you, so please follow us on Facebook and YouTube and let us know what you think. And please like and share the videos. Till next time, this is James Barras wishing you true well-being and a caring, loving connection with the world.